FM. It's the July 11th edition. 2.5 hours of interviews, songs, stories, and your accounts of what's happening out there in the world for folks without lots of money. Stay tuned and stay away. Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, as I mentioned to you before, and got lots of stuff coming at you. A lot of it's recorded today because we've been doing some taping and some of our best stuff is done on tape, but we still have a call-in number, 427-3772, we encourage you to call in on because we want to hear what you have to say. Live voices are almost always better than the canned stuff, even when the canned folks are well-spoken and have important things to say. So mixture of the two is really a helpful thing. We're going to be beginning today's show with a replay of a tape made about a week ago, maybe a little bit more, at the Coalition on Police Brutality, a group in San Francisco which is fighting with other groups throughout the country to expose and stop police violence, particularly police shootings of people, and they're being called murders by those in this group who have been investigating them, to stop the kind of violence that is happening nationwide and is being given legal sanction by police authorities and courts throughout the country. Shooting of people by accident, in custody death syndrome, as it's sometimes called, when a person gets pepper sprayed, as Steve Argue is pepper sprayed on May 22nd. Steve Argue didn't die, but Aaron Williams in San Francisco did die. And eventually the police officer involved, I think, got fired. He didn't get prosecuted. He didn't get charged with murder. He didn't get even charged with a minor violation of civil rights, a lesser charge. No, he was just, eventually I believe he was discharged. And it might have even been for another offense. So this group, the Coalition on Police Brutality, here's a bit of tape from that conversation we had, Steve Argue and others with the Santa Cruz 5 Defense Committee, involved in events that happened on May 22nd, a protest against the bombing of Yugoslavia and the Democratic Party support of that bombing. A noisy but peaceful protest which was attacked by the police and has resulted in 5 people being put up on trial, charges ranging from assault to resisting arrest, these are the kinds of charges often used by police when they can't think of anything else to put forward. In this case, Steve Argue is being accused of punching a cop who was engaged in abusive, some said torturing, of a woman, Julianne. We played her account of events about a week and a half ago. I think it was a week ago. The Coalition on Police Brutality is considering numerous cases on this issue, and let's kind of listen in.
I work with the October 22nd Coalition to Stop Police Brutality, Repression, and the Criminalization of a Generation. And I want to thank you all for coming. The October 22nd Coalition is a broad-based national organization working to build a mass movement to put an end to the growing epidemic of police brutality. Every year for the last 3 years, we've organized mass demonstrations on October 22nd in cities around the country to demonstrate people's outrage towards police brutality. And to demand accountability for law enforcement. Last year, we had over 1,000 people demonstrating against police brutality in San Francisco alone, with more simultaneous demonstrations going on in 65 cities around the country. And we're just shedding light on the truly national scope of the epidemic of police brutality. We also coordinate the Stolen Lives Project in conjunction with the National Lawyers Guild and the Anthony Baez Foundation. And the Stolen Lives Project tracks individuals killed by law enforcement since 1990. And for those of you who haven't seen this book, but this is the Stolen Lives book, which describes these cases, gives the names of the individuals, who've been killed. It's organized by area. The Justice Department is supposed to keep statistics on who gets killed by the police. They don't do it. No one does it. And it's kind of falling on our shoulders to keep track and make sure that these people are not, their names and stories are not forgotten. This book contains approximately 500 names. It was published a few years ago. We have a new one coming out at the end of July. We're going to have over 1,600 names. Okay, and that kind of gives you a sense of the support of the problem of police brutality. And they're available. Let's go back up. We in the October 22nd Coalition are committed to exposing the national scope of the epidemic of police brutality. And what I'd like to do is just kind of give you a little sense of what's going on nationally. I have been doing some research on police shootings, specifically police shootings of unarmed people. What we've seen is in the last few months is just a serious growth in the amount of people, unarmed individuals who've been shot. Just to get a sense of what's going on, does anyone have any sense of how many people, unarmed individuals, have been shot by the police in the last, just throw out a number, anyone?
3,000. Last month?
Let's say last 4 months, let's say since March.
80.
Okay. And this is just through my research, and I get articles sent to me on through email and various things. Through my research, which is in no way exhaustive, we counted 41 people. Okay, unarmed people who were shot by the police, either reaching for their waist, or they were driving away from a crime scene. People who were totally unarmed, were no threat to law enforcement, who have been killed, and this is a four-month period. Now, I have no illusion that this is in any way a complete statistic, and some people that I've talked to say that it's probably two or three times that amount. Taking that into account, basically what we're looking at is one person, unarmed person, killed by the police every single day of the year. Okay, and every day, and the numbers just keep growing.
These are just
people who were shot, okay, and are unarmed.
When you say shot, you mean killed?
Shot and killed, right?
Okay,
extrapolating, we're looking at basically one a day. Okay, now this is not counting people who were killed from chokehold, asphyxiation, hog tying, pepper spraying. It's not, you know, it's not counting people who are not, who were shot but are not killed.
This is 40 people in 4 months, is it?
What's that?
40 people in 4 months?
40 people in 4 months, and that's with the limited, you know, that's what I've counted through the limited amount of,
So 40 people in 120 days.
40 people in 120 days, my guess is that there are between 2 and 3 times the amount of people, okay? Because, we, you know, all I can do is search for national papers. I don't check them every day. I don't check all over. Occasionally I get things sent to me from small towns, but, you know, the stuff is going on. Yes, sir.
Are you asking for people also to furnish you that information? Or should we put it out to other organizations beyond the email to you?
Yeah, I mean, that would be one thing.
Do you have my email number?
I'll give it to you after. Yeah, definitely. So anyway, when you look at the true nature of the extent of the problem, you look at the pepper sprays and the hog tying, and then you start looking at, you know, adding to that people who are stopped for driving while black or brown. It's a big problem around the country right now, and has been for a while. And as a federal policy, police officers are being trained that if someone is driving a nice, that if a black or Hispanic child is driving a nice car, that they're probably a drug suspect. Do you want to know?
You said there's a federal law?
It's not a federal law. It's a federal policy. They train officers. There's a federal... There's a federal train. These people are trained to go... They're sent to these trainings by the federal government. The FBI does these trainings. They conduct the training.
Michelle, I was going to talk about that too. Specific federal grants.
Right.
So exactly. Pretext.
There is a specific grant. Exactly. There's a specific federal manual that lays out that if you were black or Hispanic driving a nice automobile, you're probably a drug dealer and you should be stopped. That's a reason to stop it. Anyway, so when you look at the whole situation, you just get a sense of the national scope of the epidemic of police brutality. A lot of people have, and you get a picture of why we at the October 22nd Coalition refer to it as an epidemic of police brutality. A lot of people have a lot of different ideas about how to stop police brutality, and amongst these, people talk about establishing civilian review boards, and they think maybe this will solve the problem. Some people think it's just firing the bad cops. Some think it's changing police procedures. Others, electing officials who might be able to change the problem. The one thing that we at the October 22nd Coalition think is most important is that we build a huge mass movement stop police brutality without a national consensus that something needs to be done. Everything else that we're talking about is just putting band-aids on the problem, and nothing is going to be solved, you know, in the long term. The good news, if there is any, in this situation, is that what we're seeing is a growing mobilization of people around the country in response to this growing epidemic of police brutality. And I just want to give you a sense of what is going on out there in the different, just some different areas where recent events have moved and mobilized people to action, okay? In Hartford, Connecticut, there was a 16-year-old kid named Aklan Salmon. He was running from the cops, stopped, put his hands up, to surrender, and the cop basically shot the guy in the back. Okay, people are, you know, outraged, and they're demanding accountability for the officers in Hartford, Connecticut. In Las Vegas, this guy named John Perrin was 32 years old. He was shot 14 times, three of those in the back, when police suspected him of a drug deal. And people are getting mobilized in Las Vegas around that. New Jersey, there was this guy Stanton Crew. He was shot. He was involved in a police chase, and the cops kind of boxed him in. He was trying to get away and backed up into one of the police cars. They figured, oh, he's trying to, you know, kill the cops with the car. Even though he was boxed in, there's no way he could have moved. He couldn't have left the scene. Shot him 27 times, okay? And you're seeing, and you just see this, you see that it's not just one area, it's not just the cities, it's not just the inner cities, it's a national problem, it's going on everywhere. We see what's happening in Chicago. There were two killings of young people within, of young people within 2 days. And one of them had a cell phone that they mistook for a gun. Anyway, you just, what's happening is that people are organizing around these issues. They're organizing to make to stop the police brutality, and we're seeing this movement that's going on around the country. And the October 22nd Coalition, I think people have this. This is a list of the different cities where we have chapter offices, and there are more than this now, correct? There are more than this now. Just to give a sense, the October 22nd Coalition was very involved in the protests over the Amadou Diallo shooting, and. Also the protests around the Admiral Lima case.
I don't know if you want any interruptions.
That's fine.
The Espresso Bravo Cafe right across from East Lake. I saw a cop in there recently. Do you know Jesse Washington? African-American police officer who shot and killed somebody William Hangston. Mm-hmm. It was over a very trivial marijuana arrest. Hangston was shot in the back of the head, I believe, and the explanation for why the officer's gun ever got drawn was just not credible to anyone. The district attorney at the time took the case to the grand jury, because most people think, the grand jury sounds really fancy, as if something's going to happen. And of course, it allowed for a very private proceeding, whereby the district attorney on the case, a guy named Jerry Coleman, presented the case to the grand jury, and he really soft-pedaled it. He basically said, he's a good cop, people really like him, but this thing happened, but you get to decide what should happen to him. And the grand jury decided not to bring any murder charges or any kind of negligence charges of any kind. But I think one thing that your group should consider doing is taking police officers who've been clearly involved in cases of violence and track where they are, because someone like Washington was taken off the street, given a desk job for a while, and then after a couple of years, things die down, people have forgotten, now they got him back doing, this kind of street patrols. And frankly, I think, if you really look at his history, that's not something that should be happening.
Yeah, and I agree with that, and
not going to be over here very long.
Let's say he's at the Tenderloin transfer. Yes. He's doing vice work, or he's doing anything.
Okay. Yes. Anyway, I just wanted to say, I think that's a really good idea. I do want to kind of keep on track, because we have some people that are going to be speaking. And there will be a question and answer session at the end. And my question would be to you, how do we do that without, when we don't have anyone inside the police department who is going to be telling us the information? I mean, that seems to be the...
Yeah, no, it's public information. You have a right to know where the officer works, and you can always call.
Okay.
You can always call and ask, where is this officer assigned right now?
Right.
What station is he working at? You can do it monthly.
Yeah.
And just ask by star numbers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that is definitely something to consider. I just want to say a little bit about the speak out and the concept of it and what we're trying to do here. What we're trying to accomplish, we decided to have these speak outs to give a forum to victims of police brutality and give them a chance to tell their story, because a lot of the time they don't have that chance, because most of the time the media doesn't cover the events. When they do cover the events, they end up demonizing the victims. Anyway, our idea is to allow, to give people a forum and to empower them and see if they're not alone, and that others are, with them and sharing their struggle. And we also wanted to give people in the community who don't know a lot about firsthand about what, you know, kind of police brutality is going on out there, a chance to hear people talking and realize, you know, it's not just the, you know, the criminals and the drug dealers that are getting beaten up and shot and killed and pepper sprayed. It's like everyday people, and you know, there's no one in this room who is not a potential victim of police brutality. So that being said, Steve is going to speak, Becky is going to speak, and then I'll have a question answer. And you're going to show video also, right?
Yeah. Actually, I don't think we have that queued up. On May 26th,
I live in Hayward, we didn't see this, and it's in between Fremont and Oakland. So what they're doing there is upgrading the Hayward area because of all the expensive housing that's being generated by Silicon Valley. So people are offloading to Hayward, the Hayward area. So they're building downtown parks, but they are tremendously harassing anyone who sits in the park, even during the days. So, you know, it'd be ad nauseum to tell you how many homeless have been pushed around recently, or even just citizens stopping with their bicycles to sit down in the park. Police are walking up and asking them how long they've been there, 10 minutes or so, and they're telling them, you're loitering, move. And we have a couple officers there that are becoming more and more aggressive. So anyway, that's all I want to say on it, is that we should focus on this weed and seed program, that it's not just Santa Cruz, it's everywhere. In Hayward's case, it's again uploading, trying to weed out the people, push people out of their housing and so forth, so that they can rent higher priced things for Santa Cruz, Silicon Valley people.
Part of why I agree with you. Part of what the focus on Santa Cruz is as well right now is this is a fundamental fight for free speech. You know, the fact that five people are facing serious charges, including myself, possible 4 years in prison. But I'd agree with you. But this is also part of the fight to maintain the political space to be able to speak out against the government and fight back. Yeah, and to keep me out of prison.
Looks like.
And that was the Coalition on Police Brutality up in San Francisco about a week ago, talking about a number of issues. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm Bathrob's peer, Robert Norris, and you can reach me at 427-3772 if you have any thoughts, reactions, objections, or plaudits, commendations for anything you're hearing. Anything you want to say, give us a call at 427-3772.
There's 168 hours in a week, and of that, 56 will be taken by sleep, leaving 112 left for you, but if you work 40, that's 72. Eating three meals takes 3 hours a day, that's 21 more you can take away, which leaves 51 you might spend at the house, at least two a day with a partner or spouse. That's quality time, 14 to be exact, with another 14 if you have kids to subtract. When you figure this time spent with your family, you'll notice you're down to a mere 23, but we must take an hour to dress and be clean, so take 7 off and you got just 16. Of course, your pets need attention, you know, at least 1/2 an hour a day, and that's low. That's 12 and a half hours left in the chute, but we almost forgot to include your commute. Let's say that your drive is 1 hour round trip. That's 5 hours more that you have to let slip. Now what about shopping and laundry and such? That's another 5 hours, and that don't leave much. When I tell you the number, you surely will laugh. Well, the time you have left is 2 hours and a half. That's 21 minutes per day you can spend, which is usually held over until the weekend to watch some TV or a show or a game for 2.5 hours. Now that's a shame. Ain't really enough there to have a good time with this 40-hour work week. It should be a crime. Now, all this could change if you'd listen a bit. If your work week was less, that would take care of it. The time you could have to yourself would be plenty if instead of your 40 hours, you could work 20. Just think what that 20 hours extra could mean in learning and playing and living your dream. And the great thing about it is that jobless folk could all be employed then, all in one stroke. No one would toil a full week 9 to 5, but with everyone working, the country would thrive. We'd adjust all the prices of housing and goods, and all take more classes and walks in the woods. With guaranteed health care from all who employed you, it's a new plan, a brand of our own perestroika. Radical maybe, but hear what I speak, and sing out in praise of the 20-hour week. Sing out in praise of the 20-hour week. Yeah, sing out in praise of the 20-hour week. Yeah.
Okay, it's July 11th, 1999. It's about 8 o'clock in the morning. We're talking to Bernard Klitzner, who's a Peace and Freedom Party activist, who's also been spending a lot of time working on issues around the sleeping ban, the Santa Cruz Five, and the Mumia Coalition. Hi, Bernard.
Hi.
And Bernard, yesterday you had an interesting afternoon, I suppose, up in San Jose. You want to tell us about that?
Sure. You know, we did a little, did a little march, over to Santa Cruz, over to, in San Jose was at a flea market, the main flea market, and we were about, I'd say about 25 people.
What was the purpose of the march?
The purpose of the march is to be able to do beefling at the flea market. It appeared, a week ago or 2 weeks ago or whatever, we were, some people were denied their rights there.
To leaflet?
Yes.
And what kind of leaflets are they giving out? How to make bombs or?
No, just, I don't really know, what was on the leaflets, but they weren't, anything to do with inciting violence or anything.
And this is at a regular flea market that happens every week in San Jose?
Yes.
And so there was some group of people who didn't want you to leave, or didn't want those you were supporting to leaflet?
That's true.
And so you went up there determined to leaflet, huh?
Oh, yes. And we did.
And was there anyone attempt to stop you? Or?
No. No. The cops stayed away. They were at least
safety in numbers, perhaps.
Oh, yes. Well, we don't know whether it is safety or numbers or whether they're changing their policy.
Did you and anybody contact the police to find out what their policy was? And I mean, was this initiated by the police or was it initiated by the flea market authorities? Or, does anybody know what this problem was a couple weeks ago where they were going after these folks for flowering?
I don't know.
Well, congratulations on your victory.
Thank you very, very much. We'll be back in San Jose 2 weeks from today. It'll be July 24th. We're going to be a big march up at one of the parks, going to one of the parks up there.
What's the purpose of that march?
Abu Jamal.
Mumi Abu Jamal.
Yes.
He's the man who is currently being held in the death row and Pennsylvania, right?
Yes, yes.
And many believe unjustly.
Yes, absolutely.
Any updates on the sleeping ban struggle or the other fight to have charges dropped against the five protesters against the war in Yugoslavia that were arrested on May 22nd here in Santa Cruz?
I know of no, updates, Robert.
Well, thank you, Bernard. Appreciate your giving us what you do know.
Thank you very much.
And that was Bernard Klitzner of the Peace and Freedom Party reporting on a successful free speech action up in San Jose at the Berryessa Flea Market, where apparently several weeks ago police stopped people from distributing flyers about the case of Mumi Abu Jamal, which the Santa Cruz City Council has even called for a retrial on that issue. I have here an interesting pamphlet which talks about the same kind of process whereby when police move to stop people from exercising their free speech rights, people respond by standing up and talking all the more. That happened back in 1908 through 1916 with the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, familiarly known as the Wobblies. I'm going to read a little bit from this, and then we'll move on to another, yet another tape, where we'll actually cover the Steve Argue case more, and the Santa Cruz Five, the press conference where Ben Rice, Steve Argue's attorney, spoke on the issues at some length and got some interesting questions. This was about a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago now. Although I'm a little bit confused, maybe it's a week ago. Soapbox Militants, Free Speech Campaigns, 1908 through 1916. Footloose rebels come at once to defend the Bill of Rights. Such a call went out in the fall of 1909 from IWW organizers in Missoula, Montana, a small, attractive university town midway between lumber and mining areas in the western part of the state. The Missoula Free Speech Fight was one of about 30 such struggles conducted by the IWW from 1907 to 1916. Wobblies campaigned for the right to agitate on city streets, not to defend a constitutional principle or to attract publicity, but to recruit members in the slave market sectors of cities where migrants gathered between jobs. Their soapbox speeches sounded seditious, unpatriotic. I'm sorry, I garbled that a bit. Not to defend a constitutional principle or to attract publicity, but rather to publicize extortionist practices of labor agents and to recruit members in the slave market sections of cities where migrants gathered between jobs. Their soapbox speeches sounded seditious, unpatriotic, immoral, and threatening to business and commercial circles, and municipal authorities were quick to pass ordinances prohibiting IWW speechmaking on the streets. Such was the case in Missoula, where the city council aimed to squelch IWW activities by making street speaking illegal. In answer, hundreds of Wobblies arrived by boxcar to assert their rights to free speech on soapboxes and street corners throughout the town. Soon the crowded jails clogged municipal machinery, and high costs of supporting extra police and extra prisoners led harassed city officials to rescind the ordinance and release the Wobblies. A pattern had developed, as historian Paul Brissenden points out, of sullen non-resistance on the part of the Wobblies and of wholesale jailings by authorities. Across the country, the boldness and intransigence of the rebels exasperated town officials, aroused wrath and frequent violence from respectable town burghers, and frequently turned the free speech campaigns into bitter, bloody fights. To the Wobblies, however, the free speech campaigns were a unique direct action technique, a means of educating workers to the class struggle and a practical necessity in countering community opposition to organizing the one big union. The Missoula victory was a prelude to the IWW's major free speech fight in Spokane the following year. And at some point we're going to talk about that Spokane fight. But apparently the San Jose free speech fight was won relatively quickly by folks simply standing up and saying, we are going to distribute flyers. It is our First Amendment right. We don't care if you don't like Mumia Abu-Jamal. We're going to be here. And I think anybody should be allowed to distribute flyers, ranging from hate flyers for the Ku Klux Klan to cooking recipes for who knows who. That's what we call the First Amendment. And it's only going to be to retain its vigor, to retain its brilliance, if people exercise it and stand up and resist when it is suppressed.
Poverty of the barrio, where trouble is the rule. I never finished school, was trying to play it cool. I ain't no fool. it isn't easy wending through the jungles of the hood. With the warring of the gangs, still I managed to stay good. Until one summer night, I rode into a fight and heard a fateful shot from where I stood. In the very wrong place at just the wrong time, Jesse was pulled in. He had no motive to commit the crime, still the tipster fingered him. The evidence was circumstance, the witnesses not sure. Still he was pressured to confess behind the precinct door. From the jungle to the cage, Jesse was locked away. 15 years to life on ice in a cell at Pelican Bay, where the dark don't hide you from the pain of guards and treatment inhumane. Till numbness pounds upon the brain, crushes you insane. Where the cruel is not unusual, they tame you like an animal. Bullets burst and bust your will to teach you not to steal or kill. They chew you up and spit you out and say you've been corrected, and all of its necessity that the public be protected. The gang got Jesse in the yard. A warning came and then a shot was fired by a guard. And when the brawl was over and the prisoners put away, in a very wrong place at just the wrong time, a lifeless Jesse lay. People said, behind the walls of Pelican, it's one strike and you're dead. For all the Jessies everywhere who never had a chance, caught between the pincers of social circumstance. Those whose skin is brown or black live on the wrong side of the track. Just wanna be cut some slack, but end up stretched out on the rack. May they gain their freedom back, outside as well as in. My name is Jesse Castillo.
Was Mark Levy, Born to be Wired, Jesse Castillo, and before that you heard the 20-hour week. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm Uncle Robert Norris, and I'm going to be rushing off to a meeting for about an hour and a half or less, and filling in for me will be my producer, Becky Johnson, who's going to probably give the show something of a different tilt. I'm not sure what she's going to do with it. Phone number to call in to join the show is 427-3772. We're going to turn now to a brief bit of tape on, the circumstances of a homeless man repeatedly ticketed for a bike light who actually apparently was too apprehensive to show up in court. And the ultimate outcome of this case is he now faces, I think it's either 100 or 120 hours of community service for not having a bike light on his bike and not coming to court. There is an attorney who wanted to help him, Tony Bull, who has volunteered his services pro bono, that's free, folks, for all you people out there who have tickets, on issues of the sleeping ban, harassment of the homeless, troll busting, things of that sort, complaints against the police department. He talks about this case, and perhaps we can get some insight on what to do and what not to do when you're given one of these largely bogus tickets. It's hard for a homeless person to buy a light for his bike under certain circumstances, and it's hard for some people to come to court and deal with the courts when they can't even have enough clothes to cover their bodies. I think Becky will be talking about that further. Stay tuned and, well, give us your thoughts on the subject. Give us a call, 427-3772.
You have to speak up. We need 5 minutes on this, Tony.
Some other time.
All right, we'll call you on and talk to you, but you just had a very successful...
No, I lost.
You lost, but you lost with flying colors.
But I lost with flying colors. It was one of my best cross-examinations. I personally think Officer Harms was squirming.
So we're talking about the case of Patrick McDermott, also known as Mark...
McBride,
also known as Mark Bourne.
Bourne, yeah.
And Mark was accused of, what, 7 bicycle tickets? Or?
Well, the one that we've handled so far, he was accused of stepping off a curb downtown at Pacific Avenue across from the new construction and Cottontails, and causing, according to the police officer, 3 cars to break so suddenly that it presented an immediate harm to Mark.
I see. So this was all for his own good, huh?
Absolutely.
And what was your response to this in court? What did you say to Officer Harms on this issue?
I tried to challenge not only his credibility, because he admitted he was 3 car lengths behind and yet saw everything as clear as day, but I also suggested that they were singling out Mark or any other homeless person in particular, in that dozens of other people, including tourists, walk that intersection illegally all the time, and yet none of them ever get tickets.
So they got a ticket for what, jaywalking?
Yes.
Amazing. I've never seen anybody get tickets. Well, actually, I got a ticket once for jaywalking in 1990, but we were doing a protest.
Well, the law says it's illegal to jaywalk when you are where a vehicle is close enough that you may cause imminent harm.
Uh-huh.
And that's what they charged him with.
And that wasn't the only... And he was found guilty in the court of Commissioner Salazar and...
No, this was from Judge Danner.
In front of Judge Danner. And was that the only officer there, or...?
Yeah, because it was only a charge.
And how did Judge Danner do on that issue? Do you feel he gave a fair hearing, or just made it perhaps an incorrect decision, or was he...
Unless we could absolutely show that the police officer was lying, Judge Danner had to go with the evidence, since Mr. McBride was not present, even though he had been warned 3 times of the appointment. There was no way to impeach the officer.
So all you jaywalkers, take note. If you're going to get a ticket, or if they're going to give you a ticket, best to show up, particularly if you have an attorney willing
to... We could have won. We might have won.
Mm-hmm.
And Judge Danner was willing to even take evidence today, withdraw the guilty verdict, take evidence today and reconsider it, but unfortunately Mark never made it today as well.
But there is another kind of a second chapter 2 of this case coming up, right?
Yes. We have 7 infraction tickets in front of Commissioner Salazar on June 4th.
And what are these for?
Dumpster diving, riding a bike without a light. I think there's 3 of those. A failure to appear, riding his bike in the wrong direction.
Is this the famous failure to appear infraction fictional crime that doesn't exist?
I don't know. I don't know. So anyways, on June 4th, we will single-handedly deplete the manpower of the Santa Cruz Police Department, as well as Capitola and CHP. If the police officers don't show up, they'll have to dismiss the charges.
It'll be a copper's convention.
7 of them.
A constable showdown.
All 7.
So we're
one after the other.
So Mark, if you hear this on the air, get your butt down to courtroom 2 on June 4th at
10 o'clock.
10 o'clock. We've been talking to Tony Bull, attorney at law, the man who I would say was largely instrumental in dealing with the injustice of the case of Patricia Gardella.
Yes.
Who is a woman you may notice, who used to park her shopping cart and was often herself at the corner of Ocean and Water Street on the Metro bench and suffered some harassment from Metro for it until this legal eagle stepped into the scene.
Yes, that's true.
Any updates on Patricia and how she's doing?
I don't know.
Okay.
But
indeed, she certainly did a little better thanks to your help.
Yeah, they dismissed. They didn't even call the officer, and they just dismissed.
Tony, you also said that you're interested in helping cases of police misconduct and sleeping ban abuse when that happens.
Well, my one comment is, and I think Patrick and Mark Bourne is an example of that, if you have attorney and you have friends who are willing to step up to bat with you, you really don't have anything to be afraid of. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're here to help you. It is a public courtroom. You'll have an attorney on one side. You'll have Robert Norris on the other. They're not going to
cut
you. That
could be a disadvantage.
Still, it's too public to do anything against you. So you have nothing to fear, mm-hmm. really and truly.
So in other words, even though it's a pain in the ass, if you actually have an attorney helping you, such as Tony is doing in a number of these cases, and we are trying to fight the sleeping ban, trail busting and police abuse, please show up in court. And if you, Mark, give a call to 423-HUFF, wherever you may be. We hope you haven't disappeared beneath the waves somewhere. We know there has been a lot of beating in the last 2 or 3 weeks, at least, I guess, had 5 cases that I've heard of. So. Tony, I want to thank you for taking a moment outside the courthouse, and if you hear anything from that Steve Argue, Lost in the Catacombs, please let us know.
Okay, you're listening to 96.3 FM and Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Becky Johnson. This is the Bathrobes Piers Broadside Show. Now, you just listened to a tape, an interview that Robert Norris did with the attorney Tony Boll about the Patrick McBride case. And I know Patrick, I know him as Mark, actually. And that was June 6th. Now, what's happened since on that case is that Mark did not show up in court again on July 2nd, even though Charlotte Cloud had sort of bent over backwards with all these bicycle tickets that had racked up against Mark. Two of these tickets he disputed, by the way. He said that in one case he was riding and the officer ticketed him for no headlight on his bike. He said he did have a headlight. He had it on. It's just that the batteries were starting to dim a little bit. Or so the officer said. He thought that there was sufficient light in that particular case. In one of these other cases, he was ticketed for digging through a dumpster, and he claims that he was just standing next to the dumpster, and that the officer had come up and made some sort of comment about a beer bottle that was an empty beer bottle that was lying on the ground, that it was his. And he had not ticketed him for an open container, but instead ticketed him for digging through the dumpster. So that was like 2 of the 7 tickets that Mark had racked up here, kind of a one-man crime wave. And due to attorney's efforts in court, Commissioner Cloud agreed to drop 7 of those 8 tickets for if Mark would just show up in the parking lot. He didn't even have to come to the court with the bicycle and show that it had an intact working headlight. And so Mark was very happy to hear that, except he had another problem. Because Mark is a homeless person and sort of stashes his property in little stashes all over town, his bicycle had been seized, he believes, by Caltrans, but he doesn't know. It could have been just an individual. So he had no bike to show up to take advantage of that, and he, not trusting the courts at all, didn't show up at all, despite Tony's efforts and the efforts of Huff. So Charlotte Cloud sentenced him to 100 hours community service on that, which is probably more than you ever wanted to know about these little dinky cases that are worming their way through the Santa Cruz County court system. If you would like to call in and comment about anything that's occurring on the show, any of the tapes we've played or comments we're making, the number is 427-3772, which cleverly spells out the initials FRSC, 427-FRSC, you can call in. play for you some music. What we have here, I'm not entirely certain of their collection of street musicians from Berkeley, and they're a compilation of Beverly street musicians, and I'm not sure which musician this is in particular, but let's all listen in, and we can all decide if he's any good or not. You're listening to, and this is the Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides, Civil Rights for the Poor, coming to you on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Okay, next up is an interview that Robert Norris conducted with Jean Kaiser, who is a psychiatric patients activist locally, and she's done a lot of good work. And on our last show, a woman was a guest in the studio who talked about how she had been accused by Officer Dave LeFevre for being under the influence of heroin, and that he based all this on that he had a lot of expertise and he knew what a person who was on heroin looked like, and just kind of like what happened to this poor woman as she went through the courts and was being shafted both by her public defender, who was urging her to take diversion, the urine test that she had voluntarily submitted to because she says she doesn't take heroin, she wasn't on heroin or anything like that, had not even been sent off to Sacramento by the time of her fourth court hearing. A real horror story, and as part of this drug war that is raging against our civil rights, using up our resources, filling up our jails so there's no room for violent criminals, and being waged against poor people primarily. So let's listen in, and this is about Jane Kaiser speaking about that case.
On the phone this morning, Sunday, July 11th, Jane Kaiser, the Patient Inmates Rights Collective. Is that correct?
Yes. Psychiatric inmate.
That's it. I knew I wasn't
right. Correct.
Correct. I knew I was never going to get that. I'm never going to get that right.
Oh, yes, you will. Repeat it.
Patient, Psychiatric and Interior Rights, Inmates Rights Collective. Okay. So, Jane, how long have you been with PIRC?
Oh, since about 79 when it got started. Some other people started it.
Uh-huh. And so that's 20 years. Has there been significant change in how people with psychiatric labels are treated in Santa Cruz County since that time?
No. In 77, when I was incarcerated and got out, I was telling everybody how terrible it was, and they were all saying, oh, it's much better now. Well, now it's 20 years later, and it's still not much better now. I mean, it is. If you want to get tortured and treated as a non-human being, you know, kind of describes how people in the mental health system are treated.
Is there an increase in volume in people being processed through this factory in the last 20 years?
Well, I'm not sure on a statistic, but I know from that article that Jay Olson wrote in the Mid-County Post that the professionals are saying, you know, like only half are being of the ones deserving to be served by the mental health system are not served, and so they're out to get the underserved. And when I first got into this, they were saying, you know, 10% of the population's mentally ill, and then they're saying 20% are mentally ill. They just want to get as many people under their thumb as they can, as far as I'm concerned. And give them the forced drugging and electroshock.
Now, the Landrieu-Petras Short Act of, I guess, 1969 or 1970, thereabouts, maybe it was a little earlier, gave certain rights to those in the psychiatric system. You want to talk a little bit about that?
As far as my experience shows, it's kind of like many years ago that blacks had certain rights, and then that was overturned, you know? Anybody that has, like, special rights, they don't really have the right, and any right written down can be taken away for anything called an emergency or, you know. Mental patients really have no rights as far as I'm concerned, and I went through all the studying of being a patient advocate and learning all this stuff and tried it out, you know, as an independent patient advocate for PIRC, and I personally just don't think they have any rights at all.
Now you are...
I mean, they have certain rights, like they can contest conservatorship, and the first time they do that, they can demand a jury trial if they lose, which most inmates aren't informed of, and it's often that they get super heavy drugs before going to court, so it's just a...
It's a bad scene for folks trying to assert their rights under those circumstances.
Oh yeah.
But you still show up at those at these court hearings occasionally, and you're kind of in.
Oh well, if I'm asked, yeah.
And are you also? I guess you've been following the, as you said, the Mid-County Post's. I guess it's the first in a series of three articles that came out. About Harbor Hills, the kind of dumping ground for folks with which were put into conservatorships.
Right.
you've been spending time also with, you know, at least on the phone and no doubt in person as well, with folks who are incarcerated in these places. How are conditions there? And
miserable. Although some people that are in Harbor Hill say it's better than the Dominican Behavioral Health Unit.
And you want to give us some more specifics on that?
Well, like once in a while there'll be an okay staff member at Harbor Hills, but it's really hard to find anybody that'll come close to that at Dominican.
Hmm.
I mean, it's just a lot of it, the attitude.
Wow. Now, so, I mean, do you have any, I mean, that's still kind of vague for those of us who haven't been inside. What can the attitude, what does it do to you, this attitude? I mean,
well, if you go up to ask for a toothbrush or toothpaste, it's like this big deal with them. I mean, like, get away from the desk, don't ask me for anything. It's hard to explain.
Dehumanizing kind of attitude?
Oh, yeah, very. Uh-huh. Very, very. The drop of the hat, they can put you in solitary or restrain you, 4-point restraint.
And
a lot of things they can do to make your life as miserable as possible.
And we have what they call a 5150, which is a 72-hour mandatory hold, a 5250, which is a 14-day mandatory hold, and I guess a 5350, which is that's an even longer hold.
Yeah, they can really hold you for life if they want.
You've been in this system and you've gotten out of it, and you also are struggling to help people get out of it, right?
Yes.
What do you advise to a person who's suddenly caught in this system? What can they do? What should they do? What kind of, if a person's put in jail, you suggest you tell them, you know, you just tell the police, I have nothing to say, I want to talk to an attorney. What do you suggest people in the psychiatric setting do if they're being held?
Well, it's almost impossible to talk to an attorney, except for the public defender person who will come over and
give you 5 minutes.
A report.
Give you 5 minutes of her time. Is there a psychiatric advocate? I know we've had George Cavallo on the air before. He's sort of the ombudsperson.